is Tuesday, October 27th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a wave of COVID-19 cases crashes across the U.S. and Europe as winter looms.
Clearly, across the board, we're seeing large increases in cases.
President Donald Trump and Joe Biden enter the final full week of campaigning. Also ahead, the American Music Award nominees are now set. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump and Democratic rival Joe Biden zeroed in on the critical battleground of Pennsylvania Monday, demonstrating starkly different approaches to rallying voters just 8 days before the polls close during the worst public health crisis in a century. Trump drew thousands as he began a final week charge through nearly a dozen states. Biden took a more cautious approach, greeting a few dozen supporters outside a Chester, Pennsylvania campaign. AP correspondent Ed Donahue reports.
President Donald Trump and Joe Biden swiped at each other over the coronavirus pandemic. A Johns Hopkins tally shows coronavirus deaths are rising in the U.S. Campaigning in Pennsylvania, the president said,
"We're doing a great job. We are absolutely rounding the corner."
Joe Biden has said the White House has waved the white flag on the virus.
No, he has. He's waved a white flag on life. He doesn't leave his basement. This guy doesn't leave his basement. He's a pathetic candidate.
Joe Biden was also in Pennsylvania, not far from his home in Delaware.
"We're going to be traveling, continue to travel. But the big difference between us and the reason why it looks like we're not traveling, we're not putting on super spreaders."
The numbers show newly confirmed infections per day are rising in 47 states and deaths are up in 34. I'm Ed Donahue.
Nearly 60 million people have already voted in the U.S. elections. And with 8 days left until voting finishes, that's more people voting early than did so in the entire 2016 election season. Despite the record numbers, there are numerous factors getting in the way of people trying to vote, ranging from health concerns related to COVID-19 to efforts at voter suppression. For more, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to VOA National Affairs correspondent Chris Simpkins, who's been covering voting rights issues during the election season.
"I've covered 5 presidential elections, and I've never seen so much contentious events going on and legal challenges to voting and voting rules and regulations. And I mean, it comes amid a pandemic in which people are concerned about voting and their safety by going to the polls. So we've already seen 60 million people have voted via mail-in and early voting, and there's been tremendous lines. I think a result of that is they don't have as many poll workers on hand to handle the demand of people wanting to vote early. So you've been witnessing long lines across the country during early voting."
Now, this is also the second U.S. presidential election since the U.S. Supreme Court struck down in 2013 a key section of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Can you explain what that section was and what its removal means?
That section that was removed made it a requirement that certain states or jurisdictions with a history of voting discrimination in the past, in the 1950s and 60s, I'm speaking about places mostly in the South like Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, they were having to obtain pre-clearance from the U.S. Department of Justice before they could make changes to voting practices and procedures. And this was designed to ensure that the right of everybody to vote would be carried out. But the Supreme Court in 2013 said that that was unconstitutional. And some critics have said that has led states to further disenfranchise voters by changing rules that directly impact minorities.
And what are some of those changes that have taken place in this election in some of those, especially southern states?
First of all, there are 35 of 50 states that have strict voter ID laws which require you to show up at the polls with a government-issued ID. This impacts mostly minority and low-income voters who might have a hard time obtaining an ID. Also, there are other laws in Texas, for instance, which say that there's only one mail-in drop box available in each of a Texas county. If you look at a place like Houston, Texas, and Harris County, Texas, that's a population of about 4 million people. And there's only one drop box in that county to handle those voters. There are other issues regarding curbside voting. And this comes at a time when a lot of voters with disabilities choose to go to the polling places, pull up in their car by the curb. Someone hands a device to them and they can vote right there in their car. But it turns out that the Supreme Court ruled last week that Alabama state officials can prohibit curbside voting. And again, it impacts people with disabilities, especially concerned about going into a polling place with the coronavirus pandemic. And then I just might mention one other thing. Transgender voters, a study was released earlier this year that basically said as many as 378,000 transgender voters would not be able to vote because their name or looks don't match their identification cards. And if you're going to a state that requires you to show an identification, a lot of transgender people without those IDs in 35 states might not be able to vote.
Even so, we're seeing record turnout in early voting, around 60 million people having voted already. Are these changes actually impacting the vote?
It remains to be seen the exact impact, but voting rights advocates say that these challenges and these decisions by the courts to limit voting and change voting rules impact minority voters the most. I mean, just in the number of transgender people who might not be able to vote, that could have an impact, especially in battleground states that the margin of victory or defeat is just several thousand votes. Voting rights advocates that I've talked to say in that case, most transgender people vote Democratic. And so if they're disenfranchised or they're not able to turn out in big numbers, that could help the Republicans and Republican nominee Donald Trump.
VOA National Affairs correspondent Chris Simpkins speaking with my colleague Jason Patinkin. The U.S., Russia, France, and many other countries are now setting records for coronavirus infections as a tidal wave of cases wash over parts of the Northern Hemisphere, forcing some countries to impose new restrictions. Countries are again closing bars and restaurants. World Health Organization top emergencies expert Mike Ryan on Monday.
I'm certainly not fully aware that people are using a single test as a reason to go out and party, but if they are, then it's very, very short-sighted and quite frankly, very silly. Very dangerous.
In Europe, the picture is unrelentingly grim as a string of countries reported record increases led by France, which posted more than 50,000 daily cases for the first time on Sunday, while the continent itself passed the threshold of 250,000 deaths.
Right now, we're well behind this virus in Europe. So getting ahead of it is going to take some serious acceleration in what we do. Maybe a much more comprehensive nature of measures that are going to be needed to catch up with and get ahead of this virus.
The gloom weighed on global financial markets on Monday as surging infections clouded the economic outlook. A month after a French court ruled against a request by accused Rwandan genocide financier to have his trial held in France, Felicien Kabuga was transferred Monday to the UN tribunal in The Hague. Kabuga, who is now 84, was arrested in a suburb of Paris in May following a 26-year manhunt. Joining us for details is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, he was initially ordered to stand trial by the tribunal in Arusha, Tanzania. What do we know about this transfer?
Mr. Kabuga was seen by medical experts on the 14th of October, who said that he could be transferred, but that he could need to be transferred to The Hague because it's a much easier journey. It's a journey he could make by road. He was transferred to the court facility in The Hague by ambulance in the middle of the day on Monday.
Why not Tanzania, where they were initially expecting to take him?
One of the justifications for his request to be tried here in France was that Mr. Kabuga is suffering from several ailments, notably diabetes, hypertension, and he's got some sort of cognitive impairment. Now, he said that particular group of ailments means that he needs to have specialized medical care 24 hours a day. Now, if he were to get a plane to go to Arusha to stand trial there, that would mean he would have to spend some 11 hours on a plane. He would have to transit through three different airports. And there's also the question of whether or not it is safe for him to be in Tanzania given the coronavirus. So that was the reason why he said he would rather go to The Hague. He also, his defense lawyers told the authorities at the UN, said that Mr. Kabuga wanted to stay in Europe because his family lives in Europe, and he felt that he had a right to a family life, as is verified in various UN declarations on human rights.
So as they are evaluating his health to determine where this trial should ultimately be, how long is this all expected to take?
That is one question we don't have the answer to. We've been given very little information on where everything goes from here. What we know is that what they're describing is in due course, the tribunal will put him before three judges who will decide on how this medical assessment is to be carried out, who will carry it out, under what circumstances. That will be the first thing. We also need to find out when he will go before this tribunal. When will they read out to him those seven criminal charges, which include charges of committing genocide and crimes against humanity? So we're looking really now to see when that will happen. But certainly, it's likely to be several months at least before he would be transferred to Arusha, if that does ever come to pass.
You mentioned his family. I am sure families of the victims and survivors as well are probably concerned given the time they've been waiting and hoping to see some sort of justice.
Indeed, all of the Rwanda genocide survivors groups here in France and also in the Netherlands have been saying this is a very positive step. Yes, he was on the run for more than 20 years. Yes, he did manage to slip through many nets in various countries in Europe and lead a seemingly comfortable life undisturbed here in Europe. But nevertheless, at the end of the day, he is in the hands of the tribunal, and they are getting this whole motion in place for him to be able to stand trial for those serious accusations of committing genocide, and of course for also encouraging others to commit genocide.
Catherine, interestingly enough, on the same day, on Monday, there was another arrest related to the 1994 Rwandan genocide. What do we know about this?
Indeed, authorities in the Netherlands issued a statement saying that they had arrested a 71-year-old Rwandan man. He had apparently been living in the Netherlands for the last 20 years. His arrest was ordered following a request for his extradition from authorities in Kigali. We do not know his name. It hasn't yet been released, but he has been described as a former banker and pharmacy owner, and he is accused of having prepared a list of Tutsis to be killed by militias in 1994. Now, that's according to reports we're getting from the Netherlands.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, thanks so much. U.S.-mediated maritime border talks between Lebanon and Israel start in earnest on Wednesday following a recent opening ceremony. Technically in a state of war and with no diplomatic relations, both countries claim some 860 square kilometer of the eastern Mediterranean's potentially hydrocarbon-rich waters. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
Held at the United Nations Peacekeeping Force headquarters in Lebanon's southern town of Nakura, observers hope the talks will delineate disputed waters that both Lebanon and Israel claim as part of their own exclusive economic zone. Negotiators from each side will sit at the same table, but communicate through UN and U.S. mediators. Some analysts say successful talks could lead to oil and gas discoveries, helping to revive Lebanon's devastated economy. However, Lebanon is convulsing through the worst financial crisis in its modern history, only to be compounded by the destructive Beirut port blast in August, causing billions of dollars worth of damage. Energy experts and other analysts like Dania Kolelat Khatib of the American University of Beirut's Issam Faris Institute say that even if commercial quantities of gas or oil were discovered, it could take years before Lebanon would benefit from it financially.
By the time you demarcate, you extract, it doesn't happen overnight. It takes a few years. By then, gas is going to be useful in 10 years. We're wishing that we can demarcate and we can get some deals. It's for public consumption. We're a gas-producing nation. I don't think it will bring immediately money to the country.
Speaking to Arab News, Mohamed Haj Ali of the Malcolm H. Kerr Carnegie Middle East Center said negotiating with Israel has important political and security results as it will lead to reducing current tensions. Some analysts, including Khatib, tell VOA that if sea border talks lead to others on resolving the land border, then those negotiations might undermine the Iranian-backed Hezbollah's justification for holding on to its weapons.
Land. Israelis are still in Sheba farms in the south. But as long as Israel is in Sheba, Hezbollah will always claim that Lebanon is under occupation, and this will give a justification for its arms. When Israel leaves Sheba, then Hezbollah doesn't have any excuse to keep its arms.
Hezbollah is both a Shiite militia that has fought several wars against Israel and a dominant force in Lebanese politics with seats in parliament. The group argues that the maritime talks neither infer normalization nor reconciliation with Israel. Dale Gavlek for VOA News, Amman.
The Australian Broadcasting Corporation is reporting Australia has formally complained about what it is calling the offensive and grossly inappropriate treatment of passengers at Doha Airport in Qatar. The report says 13 Australian women were taken off a flight to Sydney after a newborn baby was found in an airport bathroom, and the travelers were forced to have invasive internal examinations. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Airport authorities say when a premature baby was discovered in a bathroom at the Hamad International Airport in Doha, Qatar, on October 2, all female passengers on board a flight preparing to fly to Sydney were taken off the aircraft. The group included 13 Australian women. They were taken to two ambulances waiting outside the airport and subjected to strip searches. Some of the women have told local media they were terrified and weren't told why the examinations were being carried out. The Australian Federal Police have been informed, although it's unclear what powers investigators might have over an incident that occurred in the Middle East. Australian Foreign Minister Maurice Payne says Australia has formally complained to Qatar.
We also understand that the matter has been reported to the Australian Federal Police. This is a grossly, grossly disturbing, offensive, concerning set of events. It is not something I have ever heard of occurring in my life, in any context. We have made our views very clear to the Qatari authorities on this matter.
Media reports have said the Australian women could take legal action against authorities in Qatar. Australian Labor opposition leader Anthony Albanese says their treatment has been unbelievable.
Reports of this treatment are really disturbing. The idea that women could be subject to these very intrusive searches is, in my view, an absolute disgrace.
In a statement, airport officials in Doha said the baby was safe and being cared for in Qatar. They added that medical staff had expressed concern to them about the health and welfare of a mother who'd just given birth and requested she be located prior to departing. Australian authorities have said they're expecting a report on the incident from the Qatari government later this week. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
They're still trying to figure out what are the specific policies from the White House.
VOA Asia, your daily digest of top Asia stories.
Beijing has especially hazardous levels of air pollution.
Blending American and Asian perspectives.
China is protecting wildlife.
Original reports and series, education, health, technology. Stories that mean something to your daily life. VOA Asia.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. A United Nations report finds millions of substandard cars that pose safety, health, and environmental hazards are exported every year from developed countries to developing countries, largely in Africa. We hear more from Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
The UN Environment Program reports 14 million used cars, vans, and minibuses were exported worldwide between 2015 and 2018. Some 80% went to low and middle-income countries, with more than half going to Africa. The report says millions of used vehicles exported from Europe, the United States, and Japan to the developing world are of poor quality and a major contributor to air pollution and climate change. The International Energy Agency reports today's global 1.1 billion light-duty vehicles are expected to double by 2050. UNEP Executive Director Inger Andersen says much of this growth will be fueled by imported used vehicles by developing countries.
But the current way the used vehicle market operates means that developing countries, particularly in Africa, serve as, I will say, the dumping ground for cars that are no longer considered safe enough or clean enough for developed countries. This is an issue of fairness, of respect, and of equity. And also, of course, a major concern for health, both human and environmental.
The World Health Organization reports about 7 million people die prematurely each year from air pollution. Andersen says air pollution will continue to rise, and the continued export of used vehicles into developing countries will hinder their efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. UNEP finds used vehicles exported into developing countries are generally unsafe and responsible for an epidemic of road accidents. WHO calls sub-Saharan Africa the global capital for road traffic deaths. It reports Africa accounts for 26.6 deaths per 100,000 accidents, compared to 9.3 deaths per 100,000 in Europe. Andersen says UNEP is not calling for a complete ban on the export of used vehicles to developing countries, but she says the market should be regulated in both developed and developing countries. She adds developed countries must stop exporting vehicles that fail environment and safety inspections and are no longer considered roadworthy in their own countries.
Scrap vehicles belong to be scrapped and recycled and repurposed, and not in a market where they pose danger, environmental hazards, as well as road hazards.
The report finds a number of African countries already have put in place minimum quality standards, including Morocco, Algeria, Ivory Coast, Ghana, and Mauritius. Last month, it notes the Economic Community of West African States set cleaner fuels and vehicle standards from January 2021. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, but this year, most healthcare facilities are focused on the coronavirus pandemic. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to a breast cancer survivor in South Africa who is trying to protect against both COVID-19 and a cancer recurrence.
Leanne Upeter-Beer knew something was wrong. For weeks, the 49-year-old preschool principal had noticed disconcerting changes in her right breast.
So I kind of went in for my mammogram knowing that I had breast cancer. I could feel it. I knew that that was what had happened.
She was right. Hers was an aggressive, advanced form of breast cancer. A few days later, she started 6 grueling months of chemotherapy. Now that she's recovered, she takes steps to avoid catching coronavirus.
I am still very cautious. You know, when anybody's with me, they say, my God, how many times do you sanitize your hands? And I go, what have I got to lose? You know, I need to just sanitize my hands. And I don't worry to say to somebody, please put your mask on, you know, or, you know, just can you just sit a little further away from me?
Medical professionals stress that South Africa's battle against breast cancer continues even as the pandemic rages. Dr. Sadia Laher, who worked at a breast cancer unit at a government hospital, says awareness and screening have improved, but more work needs to be done.
We certainly have a better pickup rate of our cancers as well that has come to the fore with our increase in screening and awareness. Having said that, there's a lot of risk factors that have also changed, making breast cancer more common.
But Laher says there's good news.
There have also been changes in how we manage breast cancer and what we can do technological improvements that have allowed us to manage and treat early breast cancer differently.
South Africa is one of the world's most unequal societies, and the health system makes that abundantly clear. Upeter Beer says free screening is important. But she also worries about breast cancer patients who don't have the resources needed to recover.
I think it is that post-cancer treatment, that support, that's where the meat of your recovery is. It's not a very glamorous term, but yeah, I feel that makes a big difference to a woman.
Shortly after the school principal was declared cancer-free, the coronavirus pandemic landed in South Africa. She now faces the task of rebuilding her immunity while also safeguarding the 70 small children in her care. She says she's thrilled to be back, even though she knows that her job poses health risks. For her, it's a daily reminder of how precious life is. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have been trying to locate a mysterious source of gamma rays since they were first detected in 1999. A team of scientists, led by the Max Planck Institute for Gravitational Physics, say they have located an odd binary system that's made up of a neutron star with a mass twice that of our sun and a companion star with about 1% the mass of our sun. The team found that the two stars orbit each other once every 75 minutes. They determined the neutron star is a pulsar that rotates at 33,000 revolutions per minute and sends a pulse of gamma rays once every 2,000th of a second. The team made their discovery with a unique computing network that connects the computers of volunteers around the world. This computing system allowed the team to analyze data gathered by NASA's Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Canadian musician The Weeknd and newcomer rapper Roddy Ricch led nominations on Monday for the 2020 American Music Awards, each earning 8 nominations, including for the top award, Artist of the Year, where they will compete against Justin Bieber, Post Malone, and Taylor Swift. First-time nominee Megan Thee Stallion got the most nods for a female artist. The fan-voted awards will be handed out at a ceremony in Los Angeles on November 22nd. Latin music, which has seen a surge in popularity in the last 2 years, was given a big role this year with added categories for Best Album, Song, and Male and Female Artists. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Wunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.